This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Some of you might remember a conversation we had earlier this month about a Dartmouth student who went public about extreme hazing he'd experienced at his fraternity.
That segment drew a surge of listener reaction, from derision, no one forced him to join a fraternity, wrote one listener on our website, to boredom, lighten up, old news, wrote another, to alarm, this should not be swept under a rug, wrote still another.
Then last week, Boston police sought criminal charges against 14 members of Alpha Epsilon Pi, an unaffiliated off-campus fraternity where five BU students were found beaten, bound with duct tape, nearly naked, and covered with food.
And again, a surge in the media. Everything from derision to alarm. Boston University officials say students involved in the alleged hazing incident would likely be removed from the school. But others are saying, get over it. It's part of campus culture. No big deal.
Well, is it? Is hazing a normal part of college life, on or off campus? We thought we'd step back and take a dispassionate look at that question.
And we especially want to hear from college students and recent grads today. Tell us what's happening on your campus. Is hazing just what college students do? Is it no big deal as long as no one gets hurt? Or is there a new kind of cruelty going on, one that's amplified by the internet and social media and alcohol? And what about when people feel degraded, defeated, or worse, when someone actually dies? Or really, is the outside world just overreacting to sensational headline news? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We also encourage you to comment on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now from Bangor, Maine, is Mary Madden. She's Associate Research Professor at the University of Maine and co-leader of the National Collaborative for Hazing Research and Prevention, an ongoing study that surveyed more than 11,000 students at 53 colleges and universities. Mary Madden, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you.
Welcome to the show. It's great to have you. Also with us from Goleta, California, is Aldo Cimino. He's studied hazing for more than a decade through research at the University of California, Santa Barbara's Anthropology Department. Aldo Cimino, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you as well. Mary Madden, let's start with you and the extensive surveys that you have done about hazing on college campuses. You've talked to or surveyed, as I said just a moment ago, more than 11,000 students. What have you found? How prevalent is hazing?
Well, in our study, we had both survey and interview data, and we learned from the survey that more than half of the students who belong to a student organization or team had experienced at least one behavior that would qualify as hazing, and that many of those students had also, about half of them, had been hazed before they ever got to college.
Okay, so first of all, you're saying that this is beyond the Greek system. This is any college group or organization, and more than half of the students say, yes, they'd have experienced some form of hazing. So two remarkable facts there, or findings. When you say hazing, what do you mean specifically? What actions are we talking about?
So there's a range of behaviors, and the behaviors can differ, but the important thing is that it really is about joining or maintaining a membership in an organization, and that in some way this degrades, humiliates, or puts a person in danger, whether emotional or physical, and that this can happen regardless of a person's willing to participate. Oftentimes, young people think that if someone consented, that they were not hazed.
Mm. Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate on both sides of the issue here today, or the many sides, which I'm sure there are in this conversation. But let me ask you, I'm looking at a study that you published in 2011, and you categorized different types of behaviors that mm-hmm. fall under the hazing rubric. Everything from participating in a drinking game, 26% of respondents said yes, to being told to associate with specific people, not others, depriving yourself of sleep, being yelled at or cursed, being cursed at, enduring harsh weather conditions without appropriate clothing, performing sex acts, wearing clothing that's embarrassing, getting a tattoo or pierce a body part. So you have decreasing percentages of people saying, yes, we've experienced that. But that's the wide range we're talking about when we're talking about specific actual actions, right?
That's correct. It could be a wide range of behaviors. One of the common things, though, is that it really is about that group joining, and it's about coercion to do the activity in order to become a member of the group.
Okay. And the reason why I ask is because when you look at some of those things like participating in the drinking game, and I take your point about the group being the key thing here, some people might say that alcohol is absolutely, for better or for worse, a part of college life. So why should we look upon it as hazing?
Well, the alcohol definitely is a part of college life. It doesn't mean it's one of the, you know, good parts of college life. And certainly drinking games happen among lots of students, even those just gathering informally for a party. But in this case, it's drinking large amounts of alcohol in order to, again, join or maintain your membership in the organization. And for some students who have not ever drank that much before or not drank at all before this, this is, you know, a really tough experience. It also, with the behaviors, alcohol can use escalates and the behaviors escalate. And we've had several deaths within the past few years about alcohol poisoning as a result of a hazing initiation.
Mm. Aldo Cimino, let me bring you into this conversation. You've been studying hazing for a decade now through an anthropological perspective. Let me first ask you, when you hear about the findings that Mary Madden and her team have come up with, that more than 55% of college students who were affiliated with the group say yes, they've experienced some form of hazing, does that strike you as a number that makes sense? And what's your initial reaction to that finding?
My initial reaction is that I am unsurprised. There is lots of hazing, both in the United States and around the world. This is not just a local phenomenon. This is a phenomenon that we have record of in radically different cultures. Africa, South America, Papua New Guinea, many different places and many different societies. And some of our earliest records of small-scale pre-industrial societies include accounts of hazing. So this is a very sticky and very persistent human behavior.
Sticky and persistent as a human behavior. Then why is it that you think that, let's just focus on our current time right now, when these very high-profile cases come up? I mean, some of them, as Mary Madden have pointed out, end up in the deaths of college students. Why is it that there's so much focus on hazing as a negative thing, then? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that it is a fairly safe assertion to say that hazers, individuals who are putting people through this, are trying to create allies. They're trying to induct new members. They're not trying to create tombstones. And so all parties do not wish people to die. And because of the outrageousness of certain hazing practices from an outsider perspective, they garner a great deal of attention and understandable depression.
Hmm. We are talking about hazing and whether or not it's a normal part of college life. One study finds that more than half of college students affiliated with campus groups experience some form of hazing. So does that make it normal? And if so, does it make it right? Call us with your stories and experiences at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I'm especially interested to people hearing from people who think that maybe hazing is no big deal, or that maybe it's a bigger deal than ever because of things like the internet and social media. I'm joined by Mary Madden. She is a researcher from the University of Maine and co-leader of the National Collaborative for Hazing Research and Prevention, and also by Aldo Cimino. He is a researcher and a PhD student in anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who studied hazing for over a decade. Let's go to Carlos, who's calling from Lawrence. You're on the air, Carlos.
Hey, thank you for this opportunity.
No problem. What's your thought today?
I'm actually graduating this year from a college in Boston, in which I've been a student and a frat boy for the last 6 years of my life. And I just want to bring up the point that I believe that this hazing, or this period of time in which you're put through very demeaning things in order for you to gain entrance into a club or organization, I think it There's a benefit to it, and I think it's just another manifestation of something that already exists in every aspect of our life.
Carlos, can you tell me in particular, or be more specific about what quote unquote demeaning things that you yourself experienced that you found useful later in life?
I'm not going to get into specifics. There's definitely a whole veil of secrecy that we take dearly. But I definitely will tell you that a lot of physically demanding activities, a lot of running, so on and so forth, some fraternities and some sororities do go more deeper into the psychological breakdown of the pledge than others. But I can tell you that, I mean, how is that different from you getting a job in a company and you having to stay late for, you know, the first year that you work there, or having to park your car 2 miles down in the parking lot because all the older members of that company or fraternity, they get the good spots, or they get the good pay, and they get the good vacation offers.
Carlos, I'm going to stop you there because your phone line is sort of fading in and out, but I got your point, and thank you very much for your call. Mary Madden, Carlos' comments draws us back to something that I read in one of your studies, a 2011 study that I referenced before, that said that student perception of what hazing actually was quite different than what they might have decided to report. I mean, Carlos is saying, yeah, it might have been hazing, but it didn't feel like anything was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we heard that a lot from students, especially in the interviews. And part of it is, you know, for many students, hazing conjures up definitions of physical abuse. So paddling, whipping, tying somebody up, kidnapping somebody. So many times students can say, yes, those behaviors I recognize as hazing. But the other things, like the drinking games and, you know, not being allowed to associate with other people, they may not recognize as hazing. And oftentimes it's because there was no harm to anyone. And so in their view, that means a person was not hazed. And just because, you know, for one person, it's not humiliating or degrading, it doesn't mean that it isn't for somebody else. So it, you know, it may differ. The impact of the behaviors may differ on people according to especially what their past history has been. So like an example of that is you might have somebody say they were yelled at, screamed at, and cursed at in order to, you know, join this organization. And for some, that just rolls off their back. It's not a big deal. But if you're doing that to somebody who's been abused earlier in their life in some way, it can be much more traumatic. And we don't know people's individual histories.
Although, Chimino, Carlos's comment also got to something that you were, you know, sort of heading towards, and that is that many students find these rites of initiation an essential part of, as Carlos said, paying your dues and sort of getting used to what it means to belong to a group.
That is correct. One of the predominant theories of hazing is the solidarity theory. And this is the idea that hazing increases feelings of group liking or increases group cooperation among hazies, that is the individuals undergoing this together, or somehow between hazies and hazers. And we have rich anecdotal accounts of people saying that hazing has done this for them, and we have records, archival accounts of hazing in smaller societies, as I had mentioned earlier, that seem to indicate similar things. And this is a viable hypothesis. It is one possible effect that hazing may have. From a scientific perspective, we don't have a lot of careful measurement of the impact of hazing on group solidarity, so it's a tricky problem, but it's one of the questions that I'm trying to answer with my research.
Let's take another couple calls. Jacob is calling from Malden. You're on the air, Jacob.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I belong to a fraternity. In my undergraduate years at Boston University, I graduated last year, and I'm a grad student there now. And I quit my fraternity in my last semester as a senior, basically because I objected to the whole culture, including hazing. Hazing was and is a very serious problem at Boston University. It's in Alston. It's in what's called by the students there the BU ghetto, because it is a slum. And I just wanted to say that a big part of, at least at Boston University, I can't speak for Dartmouth and elsewhere, part of the problem is that students are in that neighborhood, that they're in a place that is dangerous and run down and cheap. And it really reminds me of, I guess, you know, James Q. Wilson, the sociologist, finding about the broken window, that if you have a broken window, just one in a neighborhood, and it's not repaired, the rest of the windows will break and criminality will rise.
Jacob,
but if
you do you think
the window, criminality will fall?
Jacob,
same thing
do
with Hasek.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jacob, but I did want to ask you. I mean, so basically, you're saying that these are fraternities and sororities that are off campus. They're in Allston. They're not on Boston University's proper campus on Commonwealth Avenue in Boston. Do you think that things would be different if all of those student groups and student housing were brought onto campus? That basically, by being a part of campus culture in a more direct way, that would mitigate what you saw, the hazing behavior that you saw?
Yes, I absolutely do believe that. And I put together a 6-page letter that I wrote to the administration. I gave it to numerous people in the Office of Student Life and folks like that. I did my research, did my homework. And what's amazing about Boston University is that we actually have an on-campus fraternity scene. There are frat houses right on the heart of Boston University campus on Bay State, but they're all MIT fraternities. Mm-hmm. Those are MIT's fraternities. And they are safer. They actually ID you at the door. You can't get away with too much because the campus police are right there all the time. It's a genteel neighborhood. It's well put together. It's well kept. The objection that I would hear from, you know, people in my fraternity was that MIT's culture is just fundamentally different, you know, from Boston University's culture. And maybe that's true to some extent, but I really, really, really do think that the environment matters.
Jacob, thank you so much for your call. Mary Madden, let me turn that to you. I mean, you hear Jacob's firsthand experience there saying that the university's oversight, or a university's oversight, really does matter. I mean, have you found that to be true in your surveys across the country, that the amount of interaction, oversight, and quite frankly, bounds that a university sets has an effect on the types or prevalence of hazing that all college students see or experience?
You know, the problem is, I would say that hypothesis, as a hypothesis, you know, I might be able to agree with that, but we don't have any data to support that yet. One of the things is that, you know, campuses really haven't evaluated different circumstances, whether the housing's on campus or off campus, and they haven't evaluated sort of the efforts they make to prevent hazing or to oversee it or to deal with it when it happens. So that's really where we are now in a lot of sense, is that we are trying to figure out what is it exactly that works. And we do believe that if the university or college has more oversight, that if the policies are clearer, if there's surveillance, if there's, you know, campus police around, that the opportunities would be a lot less and for really outrageous hazing behaviors to go on. But that's not to say it doesn't happen in university housing.
Aldo Cimino, what's your take on this question of university oversight? Because, you know, I've read that our producer gave me some notes from her conversation with you yesterday saying that, look, lots of anti-hazing efforts deal with just trying to get organizations to stop hazing altogether, and that in and of itself may not be so effective.
Yes. So these are complex issues, but hazing seems to persist even where it is actively frowned upon, actively shamed, and made illegal. I know of no data that suggests any large-scale impact of any anti-hazing efforts on the frequency or severity of hazing. So I'm not sure what effects these would have. The other thing to keep in mind about the locale of fraternities is that hazing can happen outside of the house. And, you know, there's famous events like scavenger hunts where they take prospective members to other locations. They can take them to fields. There's no necessity for hazing to occur in an environment where fraternities are being monitored.
Let's take a couple more calls while we can. Al is calling from Walpole. You're on the air, Al.
Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I just have a comment about the pervasiveness of hazing. From my own experience, I was hazed high school sport, hazed when I joined a fraternity undergrad, hazed when I went to basic training for the Army, and I just completed a PhD program, and one of the courses the professor actually told us this was hazing. We are going through the gauntlet to earn the degree. And in each instance, I would propose that it's more of a rite of passage as opposed to anything that was detrimental. I view the more challenges I had to overcome in each circumstance as a aspect of my success and something that I'm proud that I went through. I think that obviously certain egregious examples of hazing are inappropriate, but in general, I think there's merit to be had by working hard and enduring things to earn a goal.
Al, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Tom, who's calling from Groton, Connecticut. You're on the air, Tom.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me today. I just wanted to add a commentary. I'm a recent college grad from May 2010. I was a member of a fraternity in my undergrad years. And the fraternity that I was a member of was a strictly no hazing fraternity. We spent a lot of time in our private meetings organizing events for the potential members that we knew wouldn't cross into the hazing boundary. And if any of the events ever started to take a turn that way, there was a discussion in the House later. I just wanted to make a comment to say that, you know, for anybody out there that's thinking about joining a fraternity, there are those out there that do not haze. And also, I think at the vast majority of fraternities, if you ever feel actually uncomfortable doing something, you saying no is not going to have any impact on whether or not they will let you into the house in the end.
Tom, thank you so much for your call. I want to get another one in here. Sergio is calling from Worcester. You're on the air, Sergio.
Hi. I want to add to what the last two callers said was, I'm a college student from Fitchburg, and during my first couple of days, I was fortunate enough to meet a group that had the same interests, and, you know, they never asked me to do anything or to go through any tests or anything. I feel like, you know, people who go into college, they don't meet those people, and they feel like the people that do ask them to do favors like that, they think that's how it goes. And, you know, if I had to offer any advice, it's just, you know, meet people who aren't going to test you or going to challenge you to do certain things. Because if someone says you got to do something to be their friend, then, you know, that isn't a friend. That's just someone who's trying to get a few kicks out of you.
Sergio, thank you so much for your call. I'm sorry to cut you off there, but I want to get one last thought from our guest here before we run out of too much time. This is not an issue which there's any black and white answer, and we're not going to come to any grand conclusions about human behavior. I understand that. But Mary Madden, you've been studying this for quite some time and have done these broad national surveys. Have you found that, is there any sort of trend that you are able to discern in terms of the severity or maybe even the prevalence of hazing because of, say, the internet, that it's so easy to see examples of how other people have been treated?
No, we really haven't looked at that. And the data that we have was really the first time that this data was collected for such a large number of students and across different types of student groups. So we're hoping in the future we'll be able to say whether hazing has increased or decreased. But at this point, we don't have that information to be able to say that.
And Aldo Cimino, you're our anthropologist here who will try and help us understand why human beings do what they do. But I do wonder, is there a sense that every time there's this spike in the extreme hazing examples, people surround the issue and say, this is terrible. But in truth, I mean, our callers are telling us they found more benefit than they did drawback. I mean, is that one of the lessons you would say we should draw from college hazing?
I don't know that I would call that a lesson, but I would, as I stated earlier, call it a viable hypothesis. So what we really need is data. We need large-scale data on the impact of hazing on feelings of group solidarity. The data that we do have is very limited. So all of these people talking about these positive experiences that they have really says we need to investigate this, and hopefully we can get more of that.
Well, listeners, one way we can collect informally, and I'll admit non-scientifically, data is if you share your stories at radioboston.org. So please do. Aldo Cimino, a PhD student in anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
And Mary Madden, co-leader of the National Collaborative for Hazing Research and Prevention and associate research professor at the University of Maine. True pleasure speaking with you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, listeners, leave your comments at radioboston.org. Up next, Wesley Morris, Boston Globe film critic and winner of the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Criticism. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.